From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. There's a new project being funded, seed money anyway, by the Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. It's called the 100-Year Starship. The goal, to take humans to the stars, to spur the technological revolutions and more required for interstellar travel. Think Star Trek. The project's newly announced leader is with us this hour on Point, aiming humans at the stars and taking them there. We'll look at the goals and challenges of the 100-year Starship project. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine a starship within the next 100 years? Is that inspirational or just out there? Would you get on board? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from New York is former astronaut and first black woman in space, Dr. Mae Jemison. Her nonprofit foundation has just won a $500,000 Pentagon grant to spearhead the 100-year Starship effort. Mae Jemison, a doctor and chemical engineer, flew on the space shuttle Endeavour in 1992. She grew up inspired by Star Trek. Now she's got her interstellar travel as her mission within a century. She joins us from New York. Dr. Jemison, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, thank you very much, Tom.
Okay, so set us straight here. What is the goal exactly?
So the goal of 100-year Starship is to ensure that within the next 100 years, we have the capability right here on Earth to send humans to another star system, outside of our solar system, to another star.
Is that even in the wildest imagination, a possibility?
So when we look at the technology development, how much knowledge that we're gaining just over the past two, three decades, it has been increasing almost exponentially. And what I always like to go back and say when we're trying to figure out, is this a reasonable thing to aspire to? Just go back to the days of H.G. Wells when he wrote First Man on the Moon in 1901.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a human to the moon was just a fantastical idea. Right? We
sure.
didn't have really have regular flying machines, anything. We didn't know
pure about, science
really
fiction.
About vacuums, mm-hmm. pure science fiction. Less than 69 years later, we had a human on the moon. And if you think about it again, the growth of our knowledge, the growth of our technology, the growth of our capabilities was much less rapid back then than it is now. So, yes, we know enough about the physics of the that we know that there's a possible way of maybe generating some of the energy sources that we need. We don't know technologically how to do it, but we know that it's within the realm of physics possibility. The only thing that's stopping us right now is how do we get the public on board? How do we make this an inclusive journey? How do we ensure that folks know that the benefits will accrue here on Earth as well? It's not just a junket to go to another star system. It's something about giving us a global aspiration, a grand challenge that makes us move ahead further.
We'll look at that public support issue and a lot of technological issues here, but I'm reading about the announcement of all this coming out in the Washington Post, and they're saying, in 50 years of space exploration, humans have hardly made it out of the driveway of our home planet when they look at the moon or even Mars. And they say, you know, at the speed attained of spaceships, our spaceships so far on those trips like the moon, the journey to the nearest neighboring star would take tens of thousands of years. Now, remind us of the scale of the challenge that's now before you, Mae Jemison.
So I'm going to have to go back to why we didn't get out of the driveway, if you promise me we'll get back to that, right?
Okay.
We don't have a person, we don't have humans on the moon right now, not because of technological capability, but because of commitment and intent. So we'll get back to that.
Okay, we'll come back. Talk to us about stars. How far are they? What are we talking about here? Is this just getting to within range of one star, or is this building a starship that could, Star Trek style, your inspiration maybe, actually sort of, you know, flit around among the stars? What's the real goal, if it makes sense even to put it in those concrete terms.
So Star Trek was a very inspiring program and had a lot about our wonderful future. But my inspiration for going into space probably had more to do with the NASA program, mm-hmm. and Star Trek was a validation of it. My interest, just like our team members' interest about going into space, probably had to do with looking up at the stars and thinking about it in a different way. And I should add that, you know, what's buttressing this program, the Dorothy Jemison Foundation for Excellence, which is a foundation that I lead. But we're also working with a group of really wonderful astrophysicists and scientists and astronomers called Icarus Interstellar, who have been taking it as their responsibility to look at are the physics possible? Theoretically, what would a vehicle have to look like? And they've been doing this based on a previous project that was done in the 1970s and really moving it forward. So we've been thinking about this. Our other partner is the Foundation for Enterprise Development, which looks at how do you govern technology and innovative companies such that you can get the best out of them. So we have all of this together. What's the challenge before us? Stars are a long way away, right? Mm-hmm. So if we think about it, when we go to – we send Voyager to we like to talk to about the spacecraft that are on Mars. It takes 8 minutes going at the speed of light to get a message to Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
1.3 seconds to the moon, I'm reading here.
So it takes a long time to do these things. Mm-hmm. So the stars are fundamentally that much further. So the closest star to us is over 6 trillion years away. I mean, I'm sorry, 6 trillion miles away.
4.2 light years. Yeah. This is a Centauri.
So it's a long time. So if we were looking, it does take tens of thousands of years. If we had a vehicle going at the speed of where Voyager, which is the furthest thing from our solar, from Earth that humans have launched, it's going to take tens of thousands of years to get there. So the trick that we have to look at is to understand that we need to go faster.
Okay.
And to go faster.
A lot faster. Right.
You need to go faster. And so you need a lot more energy. And that amount of energy has to come from really innovative sources. So the folks at Icarus are looking at things like fusion. How do we've heard about fusion.
Nuclear,
you know, as
fusion,
you get two atoms and things to combine, all of a sudden you get this incredible outburst of energy. We think about fission a lot in terms of nuclear power, where it's the, you know, as you tear an atom apart or you pull it apart, then that's where you get this release of energy. But we have to look at different energy sources. We can look at our chemical rockets right now. What they do is you get this really big burst of energy, right? You watch the shuttle, you watch one of SpaceX vehicle coming up. You see this incredible plume and it just this incredible boost of energy. And basically after that, the vehicle is coasting.
Mm-hmm.
But what about if you had a constant acceleration? So you're going faster and faster and faster. There are a number of different methods we could look at doing this, so it's not out of the realm of possibility.
What the Pentagon's asking for here as well, which is arresting, is not just to get a robot out there. They want humans out there, or at least I'm reading versions here that say, you know, it might be humans awake on this trip, or it might be hibernating in some kind of suspended animation, might just be DNA slush that would somehow be constituted once it arrives. We're talking humans, which must have huge implications for the size and energy requirements. And also, even if you get to much higher speeds, you're potentially talking a 1,000-year ride here or something.
So yeah, there's a lot of work to do. It means that we have to pay attention to a very broad field. Our proposal was an inclusive, audacious journey transforms life here on Earth and beyond. Inclusive of all disciplines, we have to understand sociocultural issues. We have to understand economic issues. We have to understand life science issues. So if you go, is it a one-way trip, right?
Would we ever know if you landed? I mean, how do you even communicate back from the stars if you got there?
We got to figure – there are a lot of things to figure out, but they're within – our capability of doing it in terms of a technological arch. There are things that we can imagine, possible ways we can imagine doing this. So the whole piece about do we send humans as a DNA, you know, potential humans. A lot of folks would say, well, how do you then decide culturally, you know, socially, their interactions, their behavior, is this still human?
Right. What's the video that they is in there to watch when they become 6 years old? Or it's like the Superman vision, where it's just a DNA slush reconstituted somewhere way out there on a planet around some star, and you're going to get Marlon Brando to make the video? I guess it's too late to say, here's where you came from. Here's a picture of a distant planet called Earth.
Well, but we know that it's not just a video. There is enough life sciences information and psychosocial information that we know that there is some warmth that's transmitted between mother and child and father and child and other humans and children that make them who they are. So those are complicated questions that go beyond the realm of propulsion, that goes to speak to fundamentally our knowledge about who we are. So when we talk about inclusive and how this can transform our Earth, there's knowledge from all kinds of places. If we go a small step down the way of getting the amount of energy to be able to generate it, to control it, to store it, we're going to fundamentally transform energy on this planet. But if we start to understand how humans interact with each other enough so that we know what we need to do to have a multi-generational ship, right, that arrives with the crew intact.
Without civil wars. Quiet down in the back seat. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the 100-year Starship Project, a new push to send humans to the stars, with the astronaut who's just been tapped to lead the way. Dr. Mae Jemison is a former space shuttle astronaut, Endeavour, 1992. First black woman in space. She's won the nod to lead a Pentagon-funded campaign to fly to the stars. It's just seed money at this point, $500,000, but that's the goal, that's the idea, and we'll see what happens. The 100-year Starship Project. She joins us from New York City today. We've got so many questions, but Dr. Jemison, let me bring our listeners in a little bit here. David in Nashville, Tennessee. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a short story and then a comment.
Okay.
I'd just like to say that I just think we could spend our money so much much better. When I was in high school in the mid-80s, the space shuttle blew up. It had a school teacher on there, and I forget the name of that shuttle.
Sure, of course.
But I told my history teacher, I said, why are we spending billions of dollars on those space shuttles when on Earth we can't even see the people? We have money we could spend on schools here instead, and it just seems there's so many other things to do with that kind of money, billions of dollars, rather than going to see some stars.
Let's take it to Mae Jemison. She was an astronaut herself. Yeah, Challenger went up. She was up on the Endeavour. I'm sure it's not the first time you've heard this response, Dr. Jemison. What do you say?
So the first thing I want to say is I was in the first astronaut class after the Challenger accident. Mm. And in fact, my application was into NASA at the time. One of the things that we need to ask is, why are we spending the money? Why is this important? And if you note in our title, it was benefiting here, life here on Earth. There's so many things that come, first of all, as a direct result of space exploration, that as a direct result of space, that we take for granted every day, but we would be loath to give up.
You mean already from previous exploration?
From global positioning satellites, right? Mm-hmm. GPS systems, weather satellites, things that are clearly in space. But we forget every day that they're in space. When you look at food, remote sensing, looking at crops, being able to evaluate what kind of mineral resources are where, communications around the Earth, all of those things have been a direct result of, first of all, being in space and space exploration. The push to go to the moon with the Apollo program, it generated miniaturization because you couldn't take that much up. You needed lighter weight materials. Looking at geographic information systems have changed the way we do databasing because you have so much information it holds. And then fundamentally, what has happened, because you have to engage people's imaginations. So many people went into the sciences. The innovations that we are enjoying today come as a direct result of all the people who were involved in the sciences in the 1960s and 70s, doing that basic science research that we are now using
to change our planet, to address many issues. There's a fundamental idea that space exploration is taking money away from other programs. But for every dollar that has gone into the U.S. space program over the years, from $7 to $17 have appeared back in our economy. And that is a return that you see nowhere. And so I think sometimes we get confused in terms of, you know, is it just folks going up lollygagging because you see the shuttle go up? And you really don't see the back part of that. What we talk about now, why is it so exciting that SpaceX went up? Well, yeah, it's really cool because you have a private company that's now doing some of the things that, you know, 10 to 15 years ago we would think only a governmental organization can. But for me, the reason why it's so exciting, because it says that we're getting to the point where we can actually create industries in space, right? So we can now, people talk about planetary resources, which was looking at asteroid mining, which I think you talked about
before. Yes, we did.
But it's not just about the asteroid mining, and golly gee, was that science fiction. But it's talking about expanding the pie, expanding the resources that we have in which to address the problems of, you know, beneficial human life.
Raise the bar on Earth as we look to the stars.
Well, we raise the bar on Earth. We not just raise the bar, we create new possibilities, new potential. I think sometimes, you know, one of the things that I remark on is that this is a global aspiration. This is not something that one small group can do. This is something that requires a commitment. And that commitment doesn't mean that you're spending all your money on that. It means that we're thinking through it. Just to be able to do this, we have to ramp up knowledge. That means really looking at education. So I agree with your caller, David, that we need to look at education. My program, the Dorothy Jemison Foundation for Excellence, has looked at since 1994, how do we improve science literacy for students? But you have to give them something to think about. Their imagination needs to hold on to something.
How about renewable energy right here on Earth? Do you think it's something about it being up in the stars that raises our aspirations higher, or does it dwarf us?
Renewable energy or sustainable systems, well, the push just to create the kind of energy we need changes how we create energy here. Sustainable systems. You know, to get a vehicle going out to the stars, whether you talk about 4 years, whether you talk about 400 years, it's going to have some kind of self-renewing, self-healing capabilities, properties that we understand about how ecosystems work. Imagine if we were to understand enough about being able to create a vehicle that's self-sustaining for 10 or 15 or 20 or 100 years, what we would learn and what we could apply back here on Earth. So it's not just about a journey that starts 100 years from now. Even if we don't figure this out until 100 years from now, it's a journey that starts 50 years from now, it starts 5 years from now, it starts right now, and the application and the importance of it to our planet, to us as a species, to us as individuals, starts right now.
Excitement this week as just this commercial cargo boat went up into space. Tuesday, SpaceX launched its Dragon spacecraft. Today, captured by the arm of the International Space Station.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 0. And launch of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket as NASA turns to the private sector to resupply the International Space Station.
Dr. Mae Jemison is with us. She's been tapped by the Pentagon's DARPA, a high-tech research agency with seed money to look at going to the stars. G in Charleston, South Carolina. You're on with Mae Jemison. What do you think, G?
Well, I'll tell you, I hear a lot of skepticism going on with you know, the feel of what people are thinking on this. You know, I really feel like 70% of the skeptics are, for lack of a better word, scared to, you know, find out possibly where we came from, find out possibly, you know, I think this is a lot bigger than just, you know, if I could even say space exploration. On a spiritual side of things also, you know, there are many aspects to things we don't know
that are out there that we, you know, should learn. And, you know, if it takes 1,000 years, you know, whatever it takes, we need to be behind this project as humans.
Jim, you've got it. So you say go for it and learn on the grandest scale. And we've got it. One more, if I may. Thank you, G. Bill in Cornwall, Connecticut. Bill, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I also agree with that most recent caller. I believe that it's very important for us to remember where we are in this universe and how we occupy just a small space. And I think any program that has us look into the skies and to remind us of that makes it less likely that we're going to go and blow ourselves up on this planet. So I support such programs, and I think that our political agendas are short-sighted, and the reduction of the space program only will harm the planet in the long run.
Well, because some people might look at this, Bill, and say, well, there's a way out of here. We're sort of messing up here. We need a new planet near some other star.
Well, that's a possibility. I always look to the sky, and I have to believe that there are others out there. And I think that we don't want to forget that. And so it reduces our concerns and our worries and our problems when we realize that there are many others, or the belief that there's possibly others out there, and that it makes ourselves seem to take ourselves a little less seriously and be willing to occupy this planet and realize how precious it is, and to learn to live with each other. And that may sound very idealistic, but I think at the same time, it's probably very realistic and very few willing to admit to that.
We'll take a little idealism right here, and I appreciate your call, Bill. Mae Jemison, what's the goal here? Is it to get out and just circle around a star and come home? If you go that far, are you essentially looking for a habitable planet out there? Do you have to come up with a starship? I mean, all this is so hypothetical, but even so, a starship that doesn't count on coming down anywhere, if there's nowhere hospitable, that just could almost perpetually sustain itself and just keep moving?
So I want to go back to the last caller. You know, there is a point of idealism and realism, and you need both. In order to get to the world that we're interested in, we need to have some ideals that we want to follow, and we have to have some ability to do reality checks. So we're starting anew. The way we're approaching this is asking the questions. So we want to get people in from spirit, you know, from, you know, theologians and folks who have a philosophical and a religious basis. We want to get the hardcore folks who are saying, here's the physics of the possible. Here's some things that we need to span further. We want to get the folks who say, well, agriculturally, this is what you need. Material scientists, architects. We want to put all of that on the table and say, what, gradually build up and say, what should the mission be? Not start off by saying it's going to be a one-way mission, it's going to be a two-way mission, because we'll be able to figure that out. We have a little time to figure that out. We also are not saying that there has to be a mission, but that we should have the capacity to do one if someone chooses. 100-Year Starship, our foundation, is a nonprofit, non-governmental organization. So the $500,000 seed funding we got was to say, go out there and see what kind of incredible things you can do just to push the technology forward. You know,
$500,000 is a pittance, right? This is just to get somebody thinking about it.
$500,000 is a good amount for a startup when you're like really starting up, but clearly
going
it's
to the
much,
stars.
Much. Well, to yeah. think about it, you know, yeah. and being yeah. able to start moving yeah. things along. This isn't about the amount of literally building the vehicle, mm-hmm. but how do we think about and move the technological capacity forward? We're looking at having also a research institute in it. We're calling the Way, which is the way to do this, right?
Mm-hmm. you have to sort figure of a Bell Lab style
institute. Yeah, there. Mm-hmm. So this is the way to do this. But we want to push the technology forward. We're not going to do the technology. But what radical leaps in technology need to happen? We look at one of your listeners, the caller mm-hmm. said, mm-hmm. about the money that doesn't go in the space program. We're also looking at a fundamental decrease in the amount of money that goes into basic science and engineering research in this country. But it is, again, that basic fundamental research that is allowing us to look at biotechnology innovations and gene innovation and all of those exciting things that we consider. But if we don't continue to do that basic research, we're not going to have the fodder, the basic, the substrate material for the next 20 to 50 years. Those are the things we have to push. That's the vision that we have to have.
Let's go to Springfield, Massachusetts, and April. April, you're on the air with Dr. Mae Jemison.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am on board, definitely. I've just graduated with my degree in computer network engineering from Springfield Technical Community College.
Great.
And I'm picking up a second degree in laser electro-optics technology. And one of the exercises we do in class is we are in a special senior final presentations class, and we think about things. We mull things over. We talk about things like sonoluminescing and quantum wells and quantum science.
Mm-hmm.
And the process of having those conversations and thinking those big thoughts actually fuels other conversations. We do need to go there. We do need to start thinking about things on a grander scale. There are so many. I agree with what May said, that there are so many other wonderful experiments and inventions that come about from having these conversations and having a brain trust thinking about these things. We could potentially fix things here on Earth by having those conversations and thinking smaller, thinking renewable, and coming up with different ways to sustain life and learn so much more about ourselves and our own planet.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm on board. I really do believe we need to start strawing, you know, throwing colonies out there. And
would you go, April? Would you climb on board if it?
Please. You wouldn't even have to ask me twice. I'd pack my bags and come.
Even if it's a one-way ticket, no idea if you ever come back.
One-way ticket. I only get one chance to live, and baby, you can shoot me on a rocket. Oh, God.
April's ready to travel, ready to go. April, thank you so much. Mae Jemison, how about you? If you somehow, you know, pop this thing up in I don't know, in your lifetime, are you on board?
I'm right there. I'm right there. I used to always tell people, you know, they said, why would you do these things? And I said, well, you know, I could figure out being an astronaut was the best way I could figure out how to go into space. But, you know, if E.T. landed in my backyard, I was gone. You know, I would do it. I think that the other part of this is that there's a need for adrenaline. Humans have a need for
mm-hmm.
challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And that adrenaline doesn't, you know, we have to find another way of doing it from violence and war and taking other people's stuff.
What about Earth survival? Shouldn't that pump up our adrenaline a little bit? I mean, we've got a spaceship, right? It's our planet. We're on it. It's got a couple of problems. They seem a little adrenaline-inducing at the moment.
Well, you know, here's the view that I have from space.
Mm-hmm.
The Earth will be here. The question is whether or not we'll treat it in such a way that it's not hospitable to our life form. And that's the piece that we have to think about as we push further.
And going to the stars helps us do that here?
It'll help us think about and imagine another way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the 100-Year Starship Project, a new push to send humans to the stars, interstellar travel. We're talking with the astronaut who's just been tapped to lead the way, Dr. Mae Jemison, former space shuttle astronaut. It was on the Endeavor, 1992, first black woman in space. She's won the nod to lead a Pentagon-funded campaign to fly to the stars. It's called the 100-Year Starship Project. Challenge so immense it kind of boggles the mind, inspires as well. Mae Jemison joins us from New York City, and maybe we've got all kinds of response here. Here's a couple. Scott says, I grew up watching astronauts. Every kid wanted to be one. I don't recall anyone saying, I want to grow up to design a robot that will be launched to an unmanned mission. No, it was, I want to be an astronaut. Walk on the Moon says, we want to see people that are going where few have gone. But here's another listener says, sounds like a It says a hellish ride, 100 years in a large airplane with no set landing time. Just imagine the horror. People are ready to kill each other after just 6 hours on the tarmac. You've got a little sociology to work out there as well. Mae Jemison, please stand by there in New York. We're happy to have with us also today from Raleigh, North Carolina, Paul Gilster. He's a technology writer, futurist, blogs on interstellar travel at Centauri Dreams. He's author of Centauri Dreams, Imagining and Planning Interstellar Exploration. Paul, say hi to Mae Jemison. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Tom. And Mae, hello. Congratulations. Very much in favor of what you're doing.
Hello, Paul.
It's
great. Finally, we get to talk.
Yeah, it's great
Absolutely.
To have you both right here. Paul, take us further into the science of this issue, if you will. May's got a great big vision, and everybody's really curious about what would potentially, she's given us a few options, but what would be under the hood here? What are the first giant challenges? How do you even begin to think about this?
Huge problems, of course, and I'm a great believer in great visions, but this will require tremendous advances in our propulsion technologies. Mae has mentioned the fusion possibility that we may learn how to produce fusion for propulsion in deep space systems. But we have a number of options here.
Okay.
We don't have to limit ourselves to that. For example, even as far back as the 1950s, scientists were studying something called atomic pulse propulsion, nuclear pulse, where they were actually contemplating setting off nuclear devices behind a spacecraft and with an enormous pusher plate. And this was
like just one after another, almost like internal combustion.
Yeah, and I think you've probably talked recently, I believe, with George Dyson, whose dad was involved in all this, and that was Project Orion. But if we get beyond nuclear, the prospect that I truly favor is the idea of using some kind of sail technology. We recently had the Japanese Icarus sail demonstrate that solar sailing works, where solar photons hit a sail and give it momentum to make it move. But if we could get a laser beam or a high-powered microwave beam on a sail structure of considerable size, we could push an interstellar craft up to very high speeds and essentially leave our propellant at home here in the solar system.
And sort of pulse it out there into space. That would require a huge amount of energy back here. May's saying, well, that could work for Earth as well. Let's say in your optimal situation, your optimal scenario, how long does it take us to get, you're talking Centauri, just as the Centauri, for example?
Yeah, Centauri, of course, is the closest, and we don't know yet whether we have habitable planets there or not, but we should know within a few years. If we could push a beamed microwave or laser sail up to 10% of light speed, we could make that journey in about 43 years. Now, that is the extreme end of possibility right now, but there's nothing in the law of physics that says that could not be achieved. It would involve tremendous energy resources. It would involve something like building a laser installation in close solar orbit so we could benefit from all that immense power the sun is generating to push our lasers up to high enough power to give that solar sail or laser sail, we'll call it, what it needs to get where it's going.
10% of light speed of light, that sounds pretty daunting in itself, but maybe, hey, Paul, and Mae Jemison, we've got lots of listeners with questions here, comments. Robert in Burlington, Vermont. Robert, you're on.
Hi. I'm a skeptic, but I'm very dubious of all this. As likely as it is for us to go to the stars, it's about the same as if E.T. came and visited us from the stars, and I think that's the likelihood of that is essentially zero. We're going to have the speed of light. We're going to have the distance between stars. We're going to have the facts of special relativity. They are not going to change no matter how much technology we throw at it. It's not going to take thousands of years. It's going to take hundreds of thousands of years. Voyager, probe, it's going to take 20,000 years just to get out of the gravity well of our sun. We can waste money on junk science. Consider SDI or Star Wars. We can waste billions of dollars on junk science, and we should be spending money on an attainable goal, like perhaps a permanent moon base, space station. But you know, maybe what was in the movie 2001, we maybe will have we'll be able to see in the year 2100. But this thing about hyperspace and warp drive and interstellar travel that you see in movies like Star Wars and Star Trek, it's April and Dr. May can spend their money on that. But if, spending the public trust on that is a waste of money.
Robert, we've got
Let me. I need to follow up on a couple of things. I'm sorry to interrupt.
I'll come to you as well,
I'm going to ask Paul to come in. But fundamentally, I need to do two things. First of all, is to understand that it was $500,000 seed funding for DARPA. We're non-governmental. It's not a continually funded project, and that we have to go out and actually make it so. The second thing is that the listener never heard April, Paul, me talk about warp drives or other engines, and to call something junk science when you actually are sort of putting your imprimatur on it is really not quite the way to go. So the things that we talked about are things that push our science, that push our knowledge base, but there's nothing within the physics that we know about that doesn't allow us to reach some of these goals. And so the issue is not sort of sitting back and saying, these are things we can't do, but to explore more. We got rid of the superconducting supercollider here in the United States. We defunded it after it was almost built. Now, in order to investigate things like antimatter and other things that could have tremendous import to us in the future, we have to go to Europe or somewhere else because we stopped thinking about pushing our knowledge base. And I don't know if, Paul, if you want to jump in there with something.
Paul, let me come to you on that. Nobody did mention warp drive. That's quite true. But May, that you had a little Star Trek turn yourself on an episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation, 1993. Here's Mae Jemison in that fictional world of space travel.
Phase distortion is dropping. The next transport window opens in 42 seconds.
How long will we have, Lieutenant?
36 minutes, sir.
Fantasy, maybe imagination on the way, maybe there's something real now. Maybe. What do you say, Paul, to the big critique? It's just too far. It's too challenging. It'll take too many years, you know, on and on.
Sure. If you start talking about, are we going to have Star Trek in 100 years? The answer to that is no. But no one is talking about this. What we're talking about here with 100 Year Starship, with the organization I work for, Tau Zero Foundation, we're looking at physics as understood today. The concepts that May has been describing, that I'm describing through various beam sail technologies, and we could get into others, none of these violate the laws of physics as we understand them. They are huge engineering challenges, yes. They will take a century or more. My guess is more like two and a half centuries before we achieve the power levels that we would have to make them happen. But this is not black magic. We're looking at scientific ideas that could be implemented with the right level of energy and engineering. And the notion that somehow this is all fantasy that's being peddled as a way of diverting government money is simply incorrect. I'm hearing classic short-term thinking there, which truly troubles me. We are in a civilization that has a desperate need to start taking long-term solutions into mind. We are beginning to do that with things like climate change and with what we must do to make sure that our grandchildren have a better world to live in. We need to look at scientific projects that extend from one generation to the next and that we may not see as living people today the end of them in our lifetimes, and that's okay if they can benefit future generations.
Do you think it'll be living people on a starship like this, or DNA slush is one phrase that's been thrown around might travel?
Depends on the propulsion method and how fast you can move. If you could get up to 10% of light speed, then you would have the option of putting a living crew on a spacecraft like that. If we're talking about 1,000 years, if that's the best we can get, and it may be, we don't know. If it turns out to be that, then that world ship concept or generation ship concept may give way to very sophisticated robotics, artificial intelligence that can do what we do. And again, this idea of DNA and being reconstituted on arrival is one that in the future, in a century or two, we may well be able to achieve. So we can't rule that out, but we do know that the human race needs a backup plan. We live in a solar system that is prone to accident, asteroid collisions, comets, and so on. We need to have humanity spread into multiple places so that if anything wrong happens here, we will survive.
Mae Jemison, there's a sociological challenge. If it's not 10% of light speed, if it's not a 40-year drive trip, but a 1,000 years, I mean, think how many wars and civil wars and you name it humans have had in the last 1,000 years on this planet. They were inventing gunpowder 1,000 years ago, and off we went with it. I mean, you'd have to really think through how you kept any kind of I don't know if you can even begin to think through how to keep humans in line for 1,000 years and on a capsule. We couldn't do it on Earth.
So, of course, I believe that clearly the technological, the physical challenges are very severe. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There are a lot of sociological challenges that we have to face. And that's one of the places where we push our knowledge, that we start to understand in our research and start to dig into how do people interact with one another? What kind of things do they need to evolve and to grow? And I think just as the organization that we're creating now, the movement that we're creating now, will evolve and grow over time. So what you understand and see a vehicle that might carry people in a colony that might get established somewhere else will evolve and grow. Which brings us back to what I think is the most fundamental thing that we have to do as 100-year Starship starting off, and that is getting broad-based public involvement, because it's really clear that it's just going to pivot on our ability to integrate the imagination and include the broadest swath of people in this journey. And we'll fail if we have this posture that only a small set of people can fathom or less longer hope or to participate. So we're starting off by having a public symposium in September in Houston, the 13th through the 16th in Houston, that includes, you know, the academic and the technical folks, the public at large, those folks who want to just say, I want to understand what the pieces are. And we even want to include those skeptics that are going to push us to think about this differently and going to make us ask those questions. This follows on to a public symposium that was held by DARPA last October. And we want to now make it our own and say, the public, we want you involved from the very beginning, whether it's artists or school teachers, whether it's the physicist who works on something else during the daytime and wants to come work here at night, whether it's the folks who write, you know, fantasy like Star Trek, or Arthur C. Clarke, who has a lot to do with where we are today. We need all of those involved.
Everybody on board. Dean in San Francisco, California. Dean, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, I think all of your guests are hitting right around what I wanted to say, which is one of the things that this gives us back that we haven't had in a long time is a frontier to conquer. And I think, you know, even leaving the technological winds of this behind, the sociological impact on all of us of having an unknown over the horizon again that we're trying to find out is going to be huge. And it doesn't even matter if we succeed or not. The benefits that we're going to get sociologically, technologically, in other ways from this are going to be fantastic. And just really quick, one of your guests made the point about the super collider. Canceling the super collider is what made me drop out of high energy physics and go into computer science. So having that thing available to push the frontier will be so inspirational to people. I think we have to do it.
Big aspirations make a difference, a very material one in your life. Dean in San Francisco, thanks for that. I mean, Paul Gilster, that there was a time when humans built things that took generations. I'm thinking of cathedrals here, and back in the day when those were century-long projects, and they were done. We're still enjoying them.
Absolutely, and we had generations of people who could embark on building such things, and the fact that they might not see the end before their lifetimes was not something that was a huge issue to them. They created those structures as a gift to future generations. And I love this idea that your caller just mentioned, this notion of getting back to frontiers. If we can start looking beyond our current short-term thinking and our sort of quarterly return type of thinking toward truly distant frontiers and truly long-term solutions, then I think we reinvigorate the human spirit and we bring an aspect of philosophy into this. We rekindle what we as human beings need to be. We're exploring creatures. We always have been. We confront maybe the biggest philosophical question of all, are we alone in the universe? This kind of work aims to do this incrementally, step by step, not at huge expense as we begin this process, and I would love to see this grow over the next century toward whatever it becomes.
Hey, Dr. Jameson, what do you think? A caller earlier brought up E.T. and, you know, as unlikely as them visiting us, what's more likely, us getting out to an inhabitable planet around a star sometime within century, 2 centuries, 3, beyond, or them visiting us here?
I'm not a betting person on that, So I would say that the only thing that we control in a certain way right now is actually what we do and how we move forward. One of our partners in this SETI Institute is mm-hmm. looking for signs of whether their intelligence, whether we can go that's outside of us. So that's one point of view. But I would say that right now we have to continue and move forward and not be fearful of what we find. The whole idea of looking at exoplanets, we know now that the planets are really are in abundance in this universe, and being able to move forward. I think that there's another part of this. We really are somewhat at an inflection point in human history right now. We know that there are fundamental improvements that happen as we push ourselves, whether it's in a frontier, physical frontier, or knowledge frontier. We know that we can do better. And what we have to do right now is say that we're going to continue to seek a better future rather than hiding and just accepting whatever we have right now.
Are you confident that there's going to be funding coming along behind that $500,000 that can go in a hurry?
I'm confident, and we're working on it right now. And anybody who wants to know more about what we're doing, I have to do this, go to 100yss.org, 100yearstarship.org.
100yearstarship. Dr. Mae Jemison is leading that effort right now, joined us today from New York City. Dr. Jemison, thanks so much for joining us today. Good luck.
You're very welcome. And Paul, thanks to Paul, too.
You bet. And Paul Gilster with the Tau Zero Foundation, author of Centauri Dreams. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
A pleasure to be here, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
This is On Point.